Welcome, welcome, welcome back to the 135th attempt to silence us. We will not go quietly into the night. This is episode 135 of Game of Crimes. Welcome back. I'm your host, Morgan Wright, here with my partner in crime.
Hey, everybody. It's Murph. Welcome back.
You sure?
Si, senor.
Si. All right. Welcome back, guys. Hey, before we get started, just some quick housekeeping real quick. Head on over to Apple, Spotify, hit those 5 stars. Helps us out a lot. You can actually leave comments on Spotify. We get a lot of those comments, so please keep those coming in. Also, head on over to our website. You're going to want to do that today because you're going to want to see the book of our next guest coming up and a couple of her pictures from the past. Formerly probably classified, but now we can share with the real world, the entire world. So head on over there, take a look at that. Follow us on that thing they call social media, at Game of Crimes on Twitter, Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. But where you got to be, patreon.com/Game of Crimes. We just got through reviewing for our Narcometer review. We did Wind River, starring Jeremy Renner. What a great movie.
It was excellent. Lizzie Olsen's in there. Eric Lang, a friend of ours that was in the Narcos series. I mean, I loved it. And I'm not going to tell you what our rating was, but that's the highest rating we've ever given a movie so far on our Narcometer. So check us out on Patreon. See what we're talking about.
Unless we count Die Hard, and greatest Christmas movie ever made.
And we don't, because one of the criteria is believability.
Maintain your reconnoiter. Nothing wrong with maintaining your reconnoiter.
If we could ever figure out what that is, maybe we could.
As Rick Massa, our buddy who did the North Hollywood Shootout, said on one of our episodes, we've never said that at LAPD SWAT. Never. Never.
I don't think anybody's ever said that.
No. Hey, but head on over that. We got a bunch of other stuff too. You can't make the shit up. 911, what's your emergency? Our Q&A, things like that coming up. Our Warden of the Throne. We did some listener player requests. We discussed a couple topics where we go off the rails, we go unleashed, and we give you our personal stuff. We try to keep it middle of the road here with this stuff, but there, you get what you get. So we've had some good stuff. Patreon.com/Game of Crimes, right, Murpho?
That's it. Just come and check us out. See what you think about it. If we're open to suggestions, if you got ideas of how we can do things better, things you don't like, maybe a topic that you'd like to hear us talk about, let us know.
We're also open to bribes, cash in an unmarked bills, non-sequential, in a brown paper bag left, in a curb, let us know where it's at. We're open to bribes.
Hey, we're easy and cheap.
We're gonna have to edit that out. Maybe.
Nope.
Anyway.
Nope. Leave it in there.
Hey, but also head on over to Facebook. Type in Game of Crimes fans. Our favorite mafia queen, Sandy Salvato, rules with the iron fist with the velvet glove. If you are worthy of admittance, it doesn't take much, folks. Trust me. But you just got to answer a couple questions. Get in the group. And we have gotten ideas for episodes, ideas for Small Town Police Blotter, ideas for a lot of stuff come from you, our players that are in this group.
That's right. You say something, we listen, believe it or not. We really do.
Yeah, and here's one thing you need to listen to, too, because this is a show about crime. We talk about bad people doing bad things and bad people doing bad things to good people. We take the story seriously, but
if you haven't figured it out, we never take ourselves serious.
And how do we prove we don't take ourselves serious, Murph? Because we always schedule time, and it's, what time is it?
It's time for
Small Town Police Blotter. All right, Murph, I don't know if you know this.
Okay, probably not.
Well, this happened in Nebraska. It just happened, too. It just happened.
Okay.
A Nebraska man walked into a quick shop, and I remember the quick shops back from my day, a convenience store, and he demanded money. And what do you think he used to demand money with?
His finger.
No.
I don't know. Knife?
Nope. A Hostess cinnamon roll box over his right hand. Now, the clerk's not knowing if they were individually wrapped frosted pastries, which could kill you over time if you ate enough of them, or thinking it was a gun, handed him over the money. So this rocket scientist, 24-year-old Isaiah, it looks like Bartu, a 24-year-old resident, they quickly established he was the offender. And he attempted to flee on foot, but he was detained. Now, a subsequent search turned up, shocker, Murph.
Meth.
4.1 grams of meth.
Hey, what do we say?
Rule number one, don't do meth. A silver handgun and an undisclosed amount of cash. He was arrested on multiple felony counts, including robbery, possession of a controlled substance, and use of a deadly weapon. But guess what? This isn't the first time. He's got a gun tattooed on his right forearm. Not a good calling card. And he previously served more than 2 years in state prison on a 2021 assault conviction. He was arrested back in April 2020 for striking a liquor store employee in the head with a bottle of Jack Daniels during a robbery that netted him 2 bottles of booze.
Oh, my gosh. You know, this is just, they probably keep a cell just for this guy because he's going to be a repeat offender his whole life. And you know what? Come to think of it now, depending on how he's holding that box of Twinkies or whatever they were, and if you got that gun tattoo on your arm, maybe he thought that was the menacing thing, that somebody was looking at a gun because it's tattooed on his arm.
Tattooed. I got a tattoo of a gun. I'm a gangster.
I mean, he's a tweaker. Who knows what he's thinking?
Well, I'll tell you who's not a gangster. This guy's truly an idiot. Murph, you know, you have probably seen some strange things, especially when it comes to people wanting to, like, trying to say, hey, will you take a check for the dope? You know, or they write a bad check or they try to, you know.
Yeah.
Can't be any more stupid. Hey, this actually happened down outside Louisville, where we have our buddy, John Mattingly, is near. But he goes in, he's a 21-year-old, and he wants to purchase a Porsche, right?
Okay.
Well, he wants to write a check.
At 21.
And not just for the price of the Porsche. He tried to purchase the Porsche with a $78 million check.
Oh, well.
I'll take the Porsche and just take half the cash back. You keep the other half. Oh, sure. Yeah, no.
Well, they didn't have enough change to pay him back.
So what does he do? He tells them at Bluegrass Motorsport, the people said, we're not going to sell you the vehicle. So then he walked into the parts department looking for keys. Well, he ignored requests to leave until he got his vehicle. Fearing that something bad was going to happen because of his behavior, a worker called the cops, who arrested him after he again refused to depart the Porsche dealership. But guess what? This wasn't his first charge. A day before trying to pass the $78 million check, he tried to purchase a vehicle from a nearby Land Rover with a $12 million check.
Does he not know what the zeros on the end of that mean?
Well, apparently not, because he's a student at Indiana University, where he enrolled back in 2021. I would say he is not a math major.
Or finance, or business, or any kind of major. I got a feeling he might be a meth major.
Majoring in meth. There we go, him and his other buddy. Hey, and to round this out too, I have, because in honor of our guest coming up, and you'll understand, I have a CIA story, Murph.
Okay.
So you can now go back and do what's called FOIA, Freedom of Information Act request. So somebody FOIA'd a March 1967 report from the agency, the company, released pursuant to a FOIA request, and it heralds a remarkable scientific advancement and a scientific achievement. Guess what it is?
Not the creation of meth.
Our final examination of train caps for redacted use in the redacted convinced us that the program would not lend itself in a practical sense to our highly specialized need. Repeated checks on the state of training and equipment showed us that it was indeed impossible to train, looks like cats, but they were not able to visualize. So use, and a lot of this is redacted, use for this technique under conditions that prevail. We have satisfied ourselves that it is a remarkable scientific achievement, knowing that cats can indeed be trained to move short distances. But we do not see reason to believe that a cat cannot be similarly trained to approach. And again, however, this environmental and security factors using this technique in a real foreign situation forces us to conclude that for our, quote, purposes, it would not be practical. I could have told you without spending money, there's no fucking way you're training a cat to do any. Cats do what they want.
The cat will tell you what to do.
Now,
here, carry that grenade over there and set it off and stay with it.
And, you know, as typical with government memos, you always have to end up pat yourselves on the back for a job not well done or not done at all. But the work done on this problem over the years, they worked on this for years. No offense, Jonah Mendez, coming up soon. The CIA worked on this for years, reflects great credit on the personnel who guided it, particularly blank, redacted out, whose energy and imagination could be models for scientific pioneers. I'm sorry, who thought it was a good idea to try and train cats to set off explosives?
Well, you know what? It might be the same person that trained dolphins. So, you know, you don't want to take away credit too quickly.
Dolphins are a little different. Cats, as the owner of cats, they do whatever the hell they want. Anyway.
Yes, they do.
Well, that brings us then to this. And this one was interesting because we have some connections with this next guest, Jonna Mendez. But the way we got her, Murph, was...
Well, it's funny because when I got contacted, and you'll hear me talk to John about this on the interview, but I met her husband one time. I tracked him down when we found out we were going to have the Narcos show come on Netflix. And I was still in a job with DEA. I was looking for advice. And her husband, Tony, gave me advice that at the time I thought, no. He said, you need to find something to do in the meantime because this is going to be a slow process. I said, no, we've already got contracts. They've already started writing. This is going to happen. Everything Tony told me was true.
And by the way, Murph, before you get too far ahead, so people know who Tony Mendez is, if you've seen the movie Argo about the extraction of the six American diplomats, that is the Tony Mendez from CIA, Chief of Disguise.
Yep. And so we're very fortunate to have his wife, Jonna Mendez. This was an introduction from our Speakers Bureau agent, Dave Buchalter. Gee, sorry, Dave.
It's spaced out your name.
David Buchalter.
My personal good friend. What's his name again? I could need a note for that.
Honey, what's this guy's name again? Now, David introduced us to Jonna, and she has a new book coming out, and it just happens to coincide with the release of her podcast. How about
that?
And
not only that, I'm going down on Tuesday to the International Spy Museum. So the second day when the episode part two of this comes out, I will be down at the International Spy Museum for her event, which she hooked me up. There were no tickets available, but she says, I'll get you a ticket. So her book is called In True Face, A Woman's Life in the CIA Unmasked by Jonna Mendez. Now, Jonna, as you'll find out too from listening, retired as Chief of Disguise. So her husband was Chief of Disguise. She worked her way up from a contract wife, you'll find out what that really means, to becoming Chief of Disguise. And I tell you, just a true patriot, great mind, and just a fun person to talk to. But Murph, we're not going to hear about this. I should have, if I'd known about the cats, I would have asked her about the cats, what her involvement was with the cats. But we're not going to find out any of this unless I ask you, are you ready to play the biggest, baddest, most dangerous and clandestine game of all, the game of crimes?
Oh, yeah. This is a great interview, everybody. So get in, sit down, shut up, and hold on. Wait till you hear Jonna's experience in the CIA and just leave you with this. Meow.
Folks, you're definitely in for a treat because I was just saying, look, we got to stop because there's too much fun stuff going on in the pre-interview before we get to the real interview. So before we get started, I got to tell you, this is a high honor because you rarely meet people who are involved in one or two, you know, events that change the course of history or they're involved in big things. It's another thing to find somebody whose thread runs through many of those. So, look, this is, I got to tell you, like I was saying, I was kind of like fangirling it. So, hey, before we get started, we have to welcome Jonna Mendez to the show. So, first of all, Jonna, this is us saluting you. Thank you for your service all these years to this great country through the Central Intelligence Agency. Welcome to Game of Crimes.
Thank you. A virtual salute back to you.
It's an honor to have you here, John, and we want to give a shout out to our agent. You and I share a common agent through United Talent Agency, David Buchalter, for getting this set up. So thank you for taking the time to join us today.
It's my pleasure. You know it is. David has been a delight to work with. I'm blessed.
He is. We won't say that to his face, but we will behind his back.
That's right.
Here's another thing you're not going to do. You're not going to make fun of anybody from Kansas, because as we were finding out, John and I both have Kansas roots. And what did you call us, people from Kansas?
Escapees.
And that explains it all right there. I'm going to steal that, John. I'm going to use that in the future. I'm telling you right now.
I did an interview with the Wichita State University with the dean of the university. Very nice man. Very nice interview. And he's going to hear that, and he's just going to just not like it.
You know, we got to – so my former DEA partner, Javier Pena, he and I got to speak at Wichita State before COVID. And that's the place, Morgan, where, you know, we do a Q&A at the end of presentation, and this young kid comes up to the microphone, and he said, I just got one question. Looks like he's about 12 years old. I've just got one question. How many people did you kill? And I'm looking at him, and finally I said, you mean today? Of course, everybody laughed. And then I shamed whoever sent him up to ask that question, because that's just uncalled for. But that's my memory of Wichita State.
I had the same memory yesterday here in Virginia. Somebody next to me on a treadmill who discovered I worked for CIA and said something about a career working with murderers must have been, you know, difficult.
Oh, jeez.
They're everywhere.
That's probably somebody who's never done anything for their country except pay taxes.
I don't know.
Well, if that. Well, the other thing, too, is I'm in Virginia, too, so I'm up here in Loudoun County, just north of Dulles Airport. So living in the burbs of Ashburn. But before we get started, we've got to talk about one of the reasons that we're here. First of all, like I said, not only fangirling, I've read, I think, all your books. But Tony had a book called Master of Disguise. So, folks, in case you don't know, the name Tony Mendez is synonymous with Argo. That's where many of you got to learn his name. But you also wrote Spy Dust, The Moscow Rules, and now the one we're excited to talk about, which is a very interesting title. It's called In True Face, A Woman's Life in the CIA Unmasked. And that will be released. It's going to be released on March 5th, right? If I remember right.
That's right.
And we got, as they say in the business, an ARC, an advanced reader's copy. And I have to tell you, I just, even here right now, if I could show you, I get goosebumps just talking about this stuff, because this shit is just so much fun, you know?
It is. And the way you wrote the book, my wife, I've been telling her about it, you know, and now she wants to read it. I've got to ask you one question. She wanted to know, and this is getting a little bit ahead, but when you were going overseas with Tony, did CIA give you any language training before you went to these countries, these different countries?
For what I did, I didn't get or need any language training, but every place I went and lived, I took language. It was Berlitz when I was in Europe. It was University of Maryland was in one of my Far East locations, and I learned as much as I could of the local language. But we had linguists actually kind of attached. If we needed a language, we'd pull a linguist in with us. We went to too many places. We traveled so extensively that your fluency in any particular language would not have solved most of the problems.
All right. So speaking of languages, there is a funny one. I'll find the link. I'll send it to you. But as you were talking about Berlitz, you know, some of these online courses, and it shows this picture. And you see it says German Coast Guard, and there's this kind of cherry cheek, kind of red-haired kid sitting there, and he's sitting him down, and so he's just getting all settled, and then all of a sudden you hear over the microphone, "Mayday, mayday, this is the USS, or this is the, you know, HMS, whatever, we are sinking, this is the German Coast Guard, can you repeat, please? Yes, this is HMSO, we are sinking, and he goes, "What are you sinking of?" And that's where the commercial comes in. This is why you need language school.
Absolutely. That's cute.
Hey, well, as we do with everybody, thing of ours, Cosa Nostra, being a fine, upstanding citizen of Kansas, how did you get started in this game? I mean, were you reading, like I did, Mad Magazine and looking at Spy versus Spy? Or how did you get started in this thing of ours called the CIA?
You know, in Kansas, I had a very dear friend, and I've stayed in touch with him over all of the years. And I sent him a note the other day saying, "Oh, you know, the book's going to be out the fifth of March." And he sent a note back, and he said, "This is remarkable. This is amazing." He said, "Even though you did kind of back into it," and that's an interesting phrase, because I didn't go anywhere looking for adventure. I went from Wichita to Fulda, Germany. The Fulda Gap was where the Russians were coming with their tanks if they ever actually invaded Europe. It was geographically a hotspot. My friend got married to a U.S. Army second lieutenant, and off they went to Italy on a honeymoon on a train. And I went on a train to Frankfurt, Germany, and decided that I didn't want to go back to Wichita. You know, I was there for like 2 weeks, and I went to the Bahnhof, the train station. I got a bunch of Deutschmarks, a phone book. This was a while ago. All these things existed back then. And I started calling American banks. Frankfurt was a bank town, and everybody was there. But first, I called the American consulate. I said, "I'm looking for a job." They said, "Dear, we don't do jobs. We do visas." And then I went to, I called Bank of America. I did this alphabetically in the phone book. The fourth phone call was Chase Manhattan Bank in downtown Frankfurt. I said, "I'm looking for a job and I'm interested in," and they said, "Oh, okay." They said, have you ever worked in a bank before?" I said, "No." They said, do you speak German?" I said, "No." They said, "Do you have a work permit?" And I said, "I do not." And they said, well, why don't you just come down and talk to us? And this was the first of just a remarkable series of moments in my life when, what were they thinking? But they hired me. I had a job. I could stay in Europe. I got an apartment. I went back and forth on a train. I'm from Wichita. I thought, boy, this was the high life. And while I was working at the bank, they discovered that I was incapable of dealing with numbers. This is pretty much true today. And so I ended up working for the president of the bank, doing his English correspondence, which was, wow. It was perfect. It was great.
How old were you when you did that?
I was 19 when I went to Europe. I would have been about 20. I was a kid. The young German woman who was helping me at the bank, she was 18. Her name was Melanie. And it was a young staff.
What talk about a sense of adventure. I mean, taking yourself on your own without any prior planning and deciding, yep, I'm going to stay. I like it.
Well, I think that's going to be a good interview question for the CIA. Tell us about one of the most challenging things you did. Well, I went to Germany. I had no plan. I had no job. I had no place to live.
And I stayed. Guess what?
And I talked my way into a job. But yeah. But that was the beginning. So the whole thing with CIA, the long story is kind of serendipitous how it unfolded. But that was the beginning. So there I was. I was in Europe. So happy. I loved it there.
Well, you said you went there because if the Russians were going to cross out, was it? But what was the thing that took you over there? Was it just a sense of history? Were you planning on joining up with the army, or what made you leave Wichita and say, "Hey, I want to go to Germany"?
It's my best friend's wedding, and I was in her wedding.
Oh, okay.
I was her maid of honor in Germany. He was with the 5th Armored Cavalry, which meant he was a tank guy, and they were out in the boondocks, truly, but the border was right there, and they would see how close they could drive their tanks to the border and wave at the guards and play chicken. After the wedding was over, the wedding party got in a tank and we paraded through some little village.
Oh, that's different.
And then it was over. Then they went to Italy and I went to Frankfurt.
Most people get in a horse-drawn carriage.
There are many ways to do that.
But also, let's put this in perspective, John. When you were over there, we were in the Cold War. This is why it was, I mean, it was Soviet Union at the time when you were there and they were in Germany, right? You had the Warsaw Pact, you had NATO. And so tensions
Absolutely.
Were a little high, right?
There were still remnants of the structure that occurred at the end of the war where the like in Berlin. Berlin was at that time divided into four quarters. The French were there, the Soviets were there, we were there. So you were constantly going back and forth from different fields, from different pieces of Berlin. And the American military presence was enormous. It was, I mean, we almost owned the town. They were everywhere. Soldiers. That was still going on. The buildings were still, they hadn't been repaired. So you could still walk down the street and they were riddled with bullet holes. I had a German boyfriend briefly, and his apartment, all the cabinets, all the kitchen cabinets, all the cabinets, any locking mechanism, any securing mechanism was ripped out. He couldn't fix it because in Germany, the landlord must do it, and the landlord didn't do it. So you'd sit in his lovely apartment with all these torn up cabinets everywhere. The opera house, the top half was missing. There was a tree growing out of the top of it. It was the war was still fresh.
Yeah, that was one of the most interesting trips I took when I went over to Berlin and got to see where the original, you know, the wall was, you know, went through Checkpoint Charlie, the Reichstag, you know, and just looking at the sense of history. Because my dad, as I said, he was military. He would go, when we were living in Kansas out of Fort Riley, he would go on a yearly exercise over to Germany called Reforger. And that was one of the things they were doing is, you know, working with Germany, working with NATO, because we were concerned still at that time, you know, the Warsaw Pact, the Soviet Union was obviously the other superpower at that time. So what a time in history. So you're over there, you've got this bank. So again, and this is why we do this long form. Tell us now the path of, you're doing the English correspondence for the president, you know, for the Bank of Chase. You said Bank of America, right?
Chase Manhattan.
Chase. Oh, I'm sorry, Chase Manhattan. So yeah, you started with Bank of America and worked through Chase Manhattan.
Yeah.
So how did that go? Where does your path intersect with somebody from the agency where they start going, you're interesting. Was it them approaching you or you approaching them?
Well, that would be my first husband. There, we had a lot of Americans coming into the bank, coming into the lobby and to change money, to do whatever, cash their checks. A lot of military, but there was this group of young people, it was men and women my age, and they were coming in like every 2 weeks. And I wasn't down there. I wasn't down where the tellers were in the actual physical part of the bank. But I noticed them, and they were American, and I was kind of lonely for American company. I mean, I had a lot of German friends, but it was refreshing to see these Americans. So I got to know them, and then they were a great fun group. They were going to wine festivals. They were down on the Rhine River. They were drinking beer in tents everywhere. We were up on the ski slopes. There was an international ski club. It went on and on, but I started dating one of them, and a year and something later, I married him. That's my first husband, John Gazer. And I didn't realize, he didn't tell me for the longest time until shortly before we got married, actually, that he worked for the CIA. I thought he was a civilian working with the military. There were lots of those people. They were called DACs, Department of Army Civilians. I thought he was a DAC. He was not. He was CIA.
Was he a case officer?
He wasn't. He was, back then, he was a security officer. And so when he told me that he actually worked for the CIA, he didn't tell me that until actually after he had proposed to me.
And the deal first, and then it's kind of like.
I had accepted. He had, his parents were living in Vienna, Austria. His dad worked at the embassy there. And he had grown up in Europe working for, his dad was, you know, a government employee. And so John Gazer was just a very nice guy who was totally comfortable in Europe. He spoke fluent German. He spoke Hochdeutsch. He learned it in Switzerland when he was going to school, high school. And if you go to high school in Switzerland in the afternoon, one of your lessons is skiing. So he was also a really good skier.
Nice.
Had a fierce game of tennis. He was, to me, oh my God. So when he and I got married in Switzerland, then I became the wife of an overseas CIA officer. And that's kind of a unique category for many reasons. But one of them is that the CIA will hire you overseas, or they would back then, as what they called a contract wife. You were not a staff employee. You were a contract for the duration of your spouse's assignment. And they had all kinds of small jobs and some not so small jobs that the wives could do and would do. So I started working for CIA. I tell people I came in the back door, the side door. I started working in Europe as a contract wife. And just kind of went inside of that closed circle and took a look around.
Can we come up with a different name? Because contract wife makes it sound like, I'm just going to. But you were on contract as a wife, right? But I mean, what would they have you do, though?
But contract wife is like the somewhere on the table of organization. It's one of the categories. It's real. let's see. When I worked, the first job I worked for, the logistics person. The head of logistics in Germany, and we did things like people want to know how I can talk and the CIA doesn't just come and just yank me away from the mic but all of this is in the book or in another book, and they have approved these things.
It's all been through the publication review board, right?
They're not going to arrest any of us. We had a flight, an around the world flight, kind of like Pan Am 1. It's a much smaller plane. It was a very private flight. And it was logistics. It was just moving stuff around, things we needed, things we wanted to get rid of. And my first job was kind of handling the office part of that. What's going to go on? What's going to come off? When's it going to leave? When's it going to arrive? we were like DHL before there was DHL, but it was just a very small customer base that they serviced. So that's where I came in. It was not an exciting job.
Quick question. Is the reason he had to tell you he was with CIA, is that because they basically had to vet you? And did you have to go through some kind of a background to become a contract wife?
Oh, I know. I went through a background check. He had to tell me when you're getting married at CIA, they're very interested in knowing who to. If you're foreign, along with the memo that says I'm going to marry that my foreign fiance, accompanying it is always your letter of resignation. So they take both of them, and it's understood that they're going to do what they can with your foreign spouse. And if they clear them, you're good to go. And if they don't, they have your letter of resignation.
Wow.
It's always,
wow.
Yeah.
Is it still like that now?
I suspect that it is. You got to really love this person because they have your letter of resignation.
Now, how's that conversation going to work? You know, honey, I've got two loves, you and the CIA, but unfortunately, you didn't pass the background. So
I don't
hasta
know.
La vista.
I don't know.
Oh, man. What a choice.
Hardball.
Well, hey, but again, you know, when you're dealing with the, you know, safety and security, you're dealing with national security, you're dealing with intelligence, you know, the last thing you'd want is to have somebody who's, quote, trusted on the inside stealing all of our secrets, because we've had that happen before, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you are in a way, you are a target. Just by virtue of where you work, you are a target for a foreign intelligence agency.
Hey, and Jonna, this is a question I've always wanted to ask somebody like you too, because, you know, I read a lot in this area because I'm fascinated by the work you did. In fact, I have to tell you too, I've just finished my first book. I've got a second one coming out. It's a thriller, but it's a detective with a secret CIA past uncovers a Russian plot to start a war between the U.S. and China, and only he can stop it. Well, guess what? One of my characters in the book is based on a combination of you and Tony. So it's somebody who does disguise. I just want to let you know you are an inspiration for one of the characters in my book.
Oh, I've got to read it. I will look it up.
Well, I think you have earned some royalties now that he's admitting that.
I said it's a combination. I don't say Tony Mendez or Jonna Mendez. So, but no, it's just going through the final editing process. I'm halfway through book two. So, but that's something we'll get into later, because what I was fascinated by is it's the use of disguise, right? I think it is one of the things that helps defend somebody, especially out in the field. And this is one of the things you were really great at working with. We're going to get into that part. But the question I wanted to ask you, though, is we know that, quote, you're supposed to be cleared if you're going to have access to classified information. But we know, too, that husbands and spouses, sometimes there's pillow talk. Sometimes there's, you know, leakage. Sometimes, you know, you tell some certain things. How did the agency treat that when you were married? And I'm not going to ask you if he did, but, you know, if there was information shared that probably shouldn't have been, unless it was like in a SCIF, a secure compartmented information facility or something like that. How did the agency, you know, handle the fact that husbands and wives would have, you know, pillow talk?
I don't know that it really was an issue. There was an assumption, and I think it was probably a well-founded assumption, that you weren't sitting around idly chatting with your spouse about significant classified pieces of the work that you're doing. There was also, I think, an acknowledgement by the agency that when your husband went away and came back, that he would probably want to talk about, oh, you know, we've got to go to Italy on vacation. That is a really great place. And he comes home with a wheel of Parmesan cheese. You know, it's hard to, and you don't try and mask where have you been. It used to be a game we played in Europe that we would guess where you'd been. If you showed up with a tray of baklava, we knew where you'd been. You know, whatever you wanted to bring back to us, we knew. But we didn't necessarily know what you were doing at all. And we didn't really want to know. If you had people who were really talking out of school, it would probably surface in other ways besides talking to a wife. I mean, the agency would have concern, but I don't know that that was really an issue.
Well, the reason I asked too is because how common was it, or did you have concerns too about, especially since, you know, the Soviets at that time, KGB, would be targeting you. How concerned were you, even like the Stasi, people would be bugging your house, you know, tossing your apartment? attempting to collect information. How prevalent was that with the work you were doing and over there at the time?
It was not prevalent. In my experience, I'm thinking of all the places that I lived. The offices certainly were secured. Really important officers that we were working with, you'd have somebody come in, somebody from security. But that wasn't an issue in the residences that I was living in. I was not concerned. Had they been bugging our residences, they would have really heard nothing but boring conversation. We weren't discussing anything operational. Even when you had a party and people came, we didn't talk casually about what we were doing. I know my husband came home once from a trip. He was in security. Actually, at that time, he was doing polygraphs. And he came home and he poured himself a drink. We were talking. So I hope you had a good trip, you know. And he said, oh, yeah. He said it went well. He didn't really say who it was, didn't say what it was. He said, but you know, there was this issue with a snake. Well, my husband was petrified of snakes. And I found out years later, he told me, I said, what was that snake thing? He said, oh, that. He said, I was doing a polygraph on a person in his home, and he had a pet snake. He said, and you know that curtain rod above a window? He said, I'm facing it, and I think it was a python just resting up there, and it really unnerved me.
Jeez.
So now this is years later. Now I knew what country he'd been to, and I knew the man he was talking to had a snake on his curtain rod. But I never ever wanted to know or was told more than that.
Oh, that's enough for me to get up and leave.
And there was one other one that he did a polygraph, and the person there was had a gun on the table, just there. Those are the two things in all those years that he told me. We were married for a long time. We were married for 23 years.
Wow.
Jeez. What was the purpose of the gun?
I think he didn't want to find out. So this is for your next book, The Python on the Curtain Rod. I own that, just so you know.
You heard it here. Copyright can't be used without the permission of Ricky Bobby Inc. All right, so
I'll be your witness, John. I'll be your
there
witness.
There you go. Appreciate
okay,
it.
Okay, I'll change it to something else. I'll change it into a lemur or something. But lemurs aren't as threatening as a python wrapped around a curtain rod. Hey, I can just imagine. We actually had one of our episodes. We had a guy named Michael Franzese on, a former capo regime of the Colombo crime family. All I can imagine is some guys from the Sopranos going, "Hey, this snake likes rats, but hey, it could like you too. You never know. You know, I could just see threatening somebody with a snake, you know?"
Exactly.
Hey, that worked for me. Yeah.
Snake? What snake? So anyway, I started blasting. So let's kind of continue on from there. So, I mean, at what point does this type of work start doing more than just pique your curiosity? It's kind of like you'd like to move from being a contract rifle to actually working for the CIA. How does that path go for you?
Well, as long as we were popping around in overseas assignments, it kept going. After Europe, we came back to the States. We almost did a wheelie in the airport and took off again because we went to the Far East. And I have to tell you, you can edit this out, but place names are pretty much out of it. And I don't talk about place names, but we went to the Far East, and the Vietnam War was going on, and it was impacting the country we were living in. I got a job as a secretary, and I was a really good secretary. I didn't tell you, I put myself through Wichita State University working as a secretary, but I did. So I'm working for the executive officer of the station. And I did that whole thing. That was a wonderful assignment. That was a wonderful place. I loved it there. Then when we went back to the United States after the second tour, I had decided during that second tour that I was really interested in a group within our office, and it was the Office of Technical Service. It was the office I eventually went to work for back in Washington. It was the audio engineers, the chemists, the physicists, the disguise person, the counterfeiting guy, those guys. I thought that that looked like a really interesting place to work. So when we came back to the States, John went, he left CIA briefly, and he went full-time to school at GW University in downtown Washington. We lived at the corner of 20th and F. So he's going to school full-time. And the OTS office that I was interested in working for was up on Navy Hill, across the street from State Department.
Oh, yeah.
About a five-minute walk from our apartment.
So over by Foggy Bottom at that time?
Yes, it was, yeah. Overlooking the Kennedy Center. It was beautiful.
Beautiful, yeah.
Well, I went through the process. I applied to, I wanted to work for OTS, and they hired me as a staff secretary. Because now I'm back in the States, can't do that contract wife thing anymore, didn't want to. But I have a job. I'm working for OTS as a secretary, and my husband is full-time in school. And that was the beginning of a career at CIA. But it was hard to see that then. I didn't want to be a secretary. But I learned so much while I was doing the work. I learned that the engineers I was working with, they were mechanical and electrical engineers. They were wonderful people. They were terrible writers. this is before I knew there was kind of a stereotype about that. So I said to them, you know, instead of writing your reports, what if you just dictate them to me? Because I have to say, it's gone now, but I was the world's fastest typist. I could type as fast as you could talk. So they'd sit down and, get a Coke and a cigarette back then, and they'd dictate the report, and I'd type the report, and they got improved work performances. I got improved work performances, and I learned everything that was in the reports. And I learned how to run a project within a government bureaucracy, how to organize it, how to schedule it, how to budget it, I learned a whole lot doing that. And working in that office was an education for me. And then the director of that office, it was about 1,000 people. He needed a secretary, and I went over and applied to work for him and got the job. First, I worked for the deputy, then I worked for the director. So now I'm working as the top secretary in a 1,000-person office, and it was fine, but it was a dead end. There was nowhere to go. Grade-wise, there was no next rung up. So stop me if I'm going too fast or too slow. So I went to my boss, who was a great boss, and I say in my book, I was blessed pretty much, mostly with really good bosses, people who were interested in me having some success. I could see the Smithsonian Castle building from my office window. So I got my boss, and I said, see that? This is while he and I were canoodling on the New York Times crossword puzzle. He did his in ink. I did my own pencil. He was out helping me with something. I said, I think over in the Smithsonian that there's a job for me. And I really am thinking about going and talking to them, something I can get my teeth into, something, I remember saying, something with substance to it. Here I'm sitting at the top tier of this office that does nothing but substance. And I'm telling him that I'm bored with the work. And he said, I know you're an amateur photographer, and we have a photo capability like no one else in the world. Take some of our courses if you're bored. Take the afternoons and you can do photo, whatever, but don't leave. And that was the beginning of my professional career, was taking that training.
Well, you know, what I love about the story, John, is the fact that you had an idea of what you wanted to do, and you were willing to get your foot in the door. Whereas it seems like, folks today, they want to start at the top. They don't understand why they're not the secretary to the executive or the executive themselves, rather than get your foot in the door and then you work your way up. So, it's almost like being an entrepreneur in a government agency, to where you get to the point where you're going to tell us how far you made it.
That's an interesting use of the word. I think I was a little entrepreneurial, but not like I had a 10-year plan or anything. I was very much in the moment, and I was bored.
And you were seeking excitement.
And I wanted something more interesting. I didn't want to sit there at that typewriter any longer.
Yeah.
And it was a moment. I had a boss, and the boss said, okay, let's do that.
Nice.
Well, to your point, kudos to your boss for saying you're too valuable to let go. So let's start developing some skills. Let's find a way to keep you here.
Yeah. You know. Yeah. And they did. I mean, I never looked back from that. But then I got on kind of a career train where the next overseas assignment is back to Europe. But now I've got all this photo training. I mean, I loved working with cameras to begin with, but I'm working with cameras like that's a whole different broadcast. The cameras that we had, the capability. We had cameras in fountain pens. We had cameras in your tie, in a button on your coat, in the briefcase, in a purse, in your fake pregnant belly. We had cameras everywhere. And when I went overseas again with my husband as his dependent, always as his dependent, I worked in the dark rooms at the station. So I was a dark room person, which I loved it. Film is coming to me from all those crazy cameras that we had. Here's the one from the pregnant belly. Can you develop that? Here's the one from the lighter. Can you develop that? Now I'm working then with the other people in our photo section, a typical guy, all guys, always all guys. Would have been an RIT graduate, Rochester Institute of Technology, shoulder to shoulder with Kodak up there in Rochester. And they could sit and talk to you about the technicalities of a particular film, about the shoulder and where the curve drops down. So you want to be a little gentle when you're handling that film. And I listened to them, but I never really absorbed that. What I absorbed was that every piece of film really was precious. And you had to give it your total undivided attention. So I'm developing film. Now they're in like glass beakers. They're maybe 2 feet tall and maybe 4 inches round. And you take this piece of film that came from a Mont Blanc fountain pen that one of our foreign agents had possibly risked his life to take that film. And you drop it into this glass, it was like a flask, and you're wearing infrared goggles. And this is development by inspection, where you're waiting for these black dots to come up. You pull the film, then you end up printing each black dot. And each black dot comes up as a document. It was fun. It was exciting. That work was really great.
Well, when you mentioned that, the first thing I did is I reached over, I got a couple Mont Blanc pens. I'm sitting here going, okay, where would I hide a camera?
Well,
I better check.
It's the conversation about the camera is about a 20-minute conversation. There's just one person that could make it the camera that went in the pen. The camera in the pen was about an inch and a half long. Inside of that inch and a half camera is a film cassette, because we're not digital yet. So it's a piece of film, tiny piece of film. The lens in that camera was 8 pieces of glass inside of the camera that's inside of the pen. This was just like only one man could make them in his garage behind his house.
Wow.
So we got concerned because this was a key piece of our equipment and it was a single source supplier. You always need another source. So we went to the major optical houses in the United States. We took his schematics and we said, could you make, 100 of these for us? And the answer was always, no, we cannot build that.
They can't or they won't. I mean, they could not technically?
Technically could not.
Okay.
So then we took it to some liaison groups we worked with around the world, Friendly Intelligence Services. Although that's oxymoronic, because you always say there's no such thing as a friendly.
As the French say, everybody spies on everybody.
Yeah.
But let's say we took it to the British. And we said, can you make this? Because if you can make this, maybe we'll give you half of the production run. They said, we cannot make that. No one but that man in his garage can make it. And I say today, Hayden Peake has disagreed with me on this. I said that was, in the Cold War, one of our most important tools. Some people say, yeah, we had satellites back then, though. We had satellite systems up there.
Yeah, but satellites can't look inside a building when you've got a scientist who's stealing all the Russian secrets and photographed documents.
My reply always was, you know, we're collecting the plans and intentions of our enemies. We're not talking about today. We're talking about what are they planning? What are they going to do? And that information is in the minutes and the agendas of the meetings that are being held. So if you have a guy with a Mont Blanc pen standing close enough to Putin's desk or whoever desk it was, silently, with one touch with his pen, he could photograph an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. He could be taking notes because it still wrote. Yeah, there was ink inside the pen too. He could take notes. Putin looks away. Putin is distracted for a minute. Our guy just holds out his pen, takes the picture. Putin stands up. Our guy puts his pen in his pocket, and they go to lunch.
Whoa.
So I say, I loved the satellites and all the other tools that we used, but that it was called a Tropel. That pen was called a Tropel, and it was game-changing.
I just realized I needed to add something to my Christmas list for this year. So,
talk to Keith Melton.
Keith Melton. Oh.
The collector.
Yeah. He has done, I mean, he's also working with the International Spy Museum, right?
He's on the board. He was the one that pulled Tony and I in 3 years before that museum opened to help them organize the massive subject matter. Keith had at the time had to be the largest collection of spy ephemera in the world, and now he's donated all of it to the Spy Museum.
Wow.
It's an interesting, Murph, if you ever get back to D.C., you traitorous bastard. He left me. He used to be my neighbor here. Then he moved to Florida. So, but you get back up here. That is an interesting, and I've watched it evolve over the years. You know, it's an amazing. And I've watched the documentaries, you know, I've even got some of the books because a lot of that feeds some of the plot stuff I'm doing, always trying to make sure it sounds authentic because you know that too. It's like some people go when you tell them, hey, look, you think the iPhone is new? You think the two-way pager is new? Yeah, I can tell you, if you go back in history, you know, really who invented a lot of that stuff? Mm-hmm. Stuff came out of operational necessity that the agency needed to allow their, you know, agents, not officer seat people. That's the mistake, rookie mistake when people in this area go, yeah, I'm a CIA agent. Well, you're a spy? I mean, you're committing treason? What? Mm-hmm. They don't understand agent, you know, versus officer. But our agents over there needed a way to communicate safely. And CIA was, I would say, probably always at least, I would say, two generations, if not three, ahead of where the market was and back then in terms of capability. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's absolutely fair. We couldn't find what we needed commercially, so we would invent it ourselves. Things like bubble memory, I remember we were dealing with it before it was even a thing. We had a man in this office of technical service who did nothing but batteries. Everything we had was battery powered. And George just kept making them smaller and more powerful and longer lasting. And you put a bug in a conference room, in a wood block under the table, it's only going to last as long as a battery. You'll never, ever go in and change the batteries out on any of this stuff. And the difference that his work made was incredible. They've named a school. One of the four schools at CIA is named after our battery guy. Only four schools at CIA, and one of them is named after a guy that did batteries. Gives you a sense of how important his work was to them.
Absolutely. That was, you know, even in DEA, that was the challenge, you know, especially if you're sending, let's say you're sending an ice cooler on a go-fast boat that's coming off the coast of Jamaica to South Florida with a tracking device. How many batteries can you pack in the interior of a 55-gallon cooler to keep that running for several days so you can track the darn thing. You know, that was always a challenge.
That's an interesting problem.
Yeah. John, a quick term of art discussion, because you mentioned the Office of Technical Services. Does that still exist today, or is that morphed into, how does that play with the Directorate of Science and Technology?
I believe that it has been pulled apart and various capabilities kind of repositioned. I think the capabilities certainly exist and are probably improved. But I think as an office, I might not recognize it. And it's one of those things, I don't go probing for this stuff. I don't need to know it. And they don't need to tell me. So I'm a little in the dark on some of it.
Okay. Yeah, because, I mean, you go back in history and read the books and you'll see OTS, but in some of the current terminology and stuff, OTS doesn't exist, you know, in terms of how they describe things today. So I know at some point they move things out. I had a mutual acquaintance, or maybe you might know him, Glenn Gaffney.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Glenn lives in our area, run into him all the time for coffee, but that was one of the things he ran was the Director of Science and Technology. I was bouncing an idea off of him, and I liked one of the things he said, which is emblematic of the way CIA thinks about things. He goes, I always told my people, if the rules of the game aren't working for you, don't change the rules, change the game.
Good. Good thought.
And I incorporate that a lot, like I said, into the plot stuff. So let's continue on from there, because this kind of stuff is fascinating, because I think, you know, we've had women on the show, but they've been from a law enforcement perspective. Now, we actually had one, Tracy, just spaced out her name, Murph.
I'm looking it up now.
She started off CIA right around 9/11 and eventually went to the FBI.
Tracy Walder.
Tracy Walder, yes. But from somebody who's done, but somebody whose entire career is CIA like that, you know, a warrior of the night. That's, by the way, I'm going to ask you about the one chapter out of one of your books. It was Smoking Bolts, the operation where you were protecting an agent who actually, if I remember right, showed up at your wedding in Virginia when you got remarried.
Oh, these stories. Yes.
So just to let you know, not only do I read, you should see my copies, especially on my Kindle. I've got stuff highlighted, notes saved. You guys have been a real inspiration. But let's talk about, you're doing the photography. At what point do you go from doing back office stuff, you know, and like I said, processing, but what point do you get to start becoming the tip of the spear? What point do you get to start going out and doing operations?
It was during that... It was during the overseas assignment where I was working in the dark room, and I was mostly working with chemicals. I was working in the dark. What I wanted to do, what I had my eye on, was to actually do the training of our foreign assets. The men I worked with in that photo section, they went out with the case officers, met with the foreign asset, trained them in using whatever camera device was going to be appropriate for this scenario, and made sure they understood how the equipment worked, how they would use it. I wanted to do that. I thought, I'm perfectly capable of doing that. I can tell them backwards and forwards how to do that. I talked to a couple of the guys. All the time here is guys, just, you have to keep that in mind. And they're like, yeah, you know, it's, you have to be careful. You have to encourage them. You have to take time and kind of slow down, make sure they get it and everything. They said, but they're not going to want to hear this from a woman. And I was, I thought, why not? Yeah, No, they said there a lot of these, if they're Middle Eastern, for instance, they give women no currency. Women have no value. They're not going to trust you to protect them and show them how to keep from getting. And I said, I think I could do that. So what happened was something came up and everybody was gone. And my boss, the head of that photo section, came in and said, you know, there's a thing here locally in town today. There's a man. He's here. He's going to go back where he came from. We're not interested in him. We're interested in his brother who lives in this country that we're concerned with and is highly placed. We want to train the man here who's here in town to train his brother It's called a bridge agent. I'd never heard of this before. And they said, do you think you could do that? I said, sure, I can do that. So I met this gentleman in a very nice hotel, the best one in the city. He comes in a three-piece suit. We rolled up our sleeves. I said, this was a secret writing system. This was not photography. And secret writing was part of the photo group. We did SW, secret writing. We did micro dots. We did all kinds of stuff. So I said, okay, here's how you do it. This is how you do it. This is what you want to teach your brother. So pretend I'm your brother. Teach me how to do this. So he did. I said, do it again. So he did. Did it three times. I said, it's clear to me you've got it. Tell him if he follows all of these rules that you're going to teach him, there's no way that the sensors or no one is going to interrupt his mail where the secret writing will be found. And so off he went. I sat down outside of the hotel, met with the case officer at a cafe. He said, I think it went really well because he was there for part of it. The case officer was, but not all of it. And then the mail started coming from that country. And it was perfect. It was textbook. It was like this could be the book for how to present, how to write a secret writing message that cannot be detected. And then the holidays were coming, and this piece of mail came in, and it was a Christmas card in secret writing. His brother had sat down with a piece of paper in this foreign country and drew a Christmas tree, what he thought it should look like. And at the bottom, he had written in secret writing, he wrote, Merry Christmas, Jane. That was the fake name I used when I trained his brother. Merry Christmas, Jane. And I thought, oh, God, this breaks every rule of, you know, this guy. And anyway, the men in the office thought that was pretty cool because no one had ever sent them a secret writing Christmas card.
Oh, my gosh. And a woman taught him. Oh, Lord, how did that happen?
And the operation was great. And that was the beginning of my stepping out of the dark room.
Hey, players, that is the end of part one. Part two comes out, as always, on Tuesday. In the meantime, go check us out at Game of Crimes on Twitter, at Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. Also, go check out our website, gameofcrimespodcast.com. We've got a lot more information there, including our book list. Any book written by our guests will be listed there. In the meantime, go check us out also, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. It's where we put a lot more content you won't hear on our regular podcast. We go into a lot more topics, and folks, it is a lot of fun. So go check us out, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. In the meantime, everybody stay safe. We'll see you tomorrow for part two.